Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Welcome to Interchange. I'm your host tonight, Allison Bektesh. I have here in the studio with me Catherine O'Connor, who is the Vice President of Public Policy for Planned Parenthood of Indiana. Catherine, thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Allison. It's wonderful to be here.
So I've invited you in because I've noticed that reproductive rights are quite the topic over the years, and Indiana especially has put that in the forefront with some of their legislation, and that's what I want to be talking about throughout the evening. I want to start, though, with giving you the chance to introduce yourself and your role within the Planned Parenthood of Indiana Network.
Okay, sure. Well, Planned Parenthood is Indiana's primary family planning service provider in the state. We've been in business 80 years. We're celebrating our 80th anniversary this year, so we're very proud of our history in Indiana. We have 28 health centers around the state, and our primary function, as I said, is to help folks with family planning. We're a staff of about 130 folks. I run our public policy division of our office. There are three of us and then a group of interns who are in that group. And our job is to help influence public policy in our state, working with community leaders, legislators, policymakers around the state to help them understand the importance of the role of family planning in making strong communities around our state.
Catherine, can you tell me your background in public policy and advocating for different issues?
Sure. My career has been in public service. I served for, 19 years in a couple of different roles at a state agency called the Criminal Justice Institute, and then had roles in Governor O'Bannon's administration, and then served as public safety policy director for Governor Kernan. I see that as a natural path to Planned Parenthood. The notion that we had at the Criminal Justice Institute and in my work in the public safety agencies was building strong, thriving communities. And the best way to build strong, thriving communities is to have individuals in those communities who are strong and thriving. And this sort of gets to be like the leg bone connects to the hip bone. But when people are able to exercise their individual freedom and their individual responsibility for themselves and their families, they have better opportunities to thrive. They suffer less from hunger. Children are better prepared to enter school. When children are better prepared to enter school, they perform better at school. They have less of a chance of dropping out. There's less of a chance that they get involved in the criminal and juvenile justice systems. They become the kind of workers that we're looking for. They become 21st century workers because they have done well in their educational career. They have gone on to succeed, and then they turn around and become productive, involved, interested people in their community. So I see it as a continuum and as a path for all of us to succeed.
Wonderful. Thank you. You're calling it family planning,
mm-hmm.
and another euphemism, I guess, is reproductive rights. And mm-hmm. another thing that Planned Parenthood is called is just a health center. Can you talk about how it provides that full circle?
Sure, absolutely. In addition to the family planning services we provide, we do a great deal of sexuality education for groups of all ages. We do breast exams. We do testing for STDs and much of that kind of work. As a matter of fact, over time, we've had flu shots available at some of our centers and provided other mainstream healthcare services as well.
And who's coming to Planned Parenthood, and for what services?
Sure, our primary audience is women. Although there's a growing number of men who take advantage of our services, our age range is primarily 19 to 24 year olds. Oftentimes, people think that we just serve women who are younger than that, and that's not true. We can run the gamut, services of men and women of all ages, and that's a thing that we would like to have people know. Oftentimes when people drop off after maybe they turn 24, 25 years old, they mistakenly think that Planned Parenthood is not there to serve them. Or sometimes folks get a job, or what they talk about, a real job, and then they move on from Planned Parenthood. And we want folks to understand that we provide high-quality, affordable health care to all kinds of folks. So there's no reason to move on from Planned Parenthood. And for women, again, primarily, who maybe have used other services as they've had their families, Planned Parenthood is a terrific place to come back to for well women kinds of services once your family is in place and you're ready to return for your own health care.
You kind of alluded to this, because if you go onto a real job, you'd assume that there is real health insurance involved. So what is the income wage, or do you need health insurance to show up to Planned Parenthood?
We take health insurance plans, but it's not necessary. Planned Parenthood is a not-for-profit. We have some funding through grants, and those services that folks can provide that they can pay for help cover the cost of services to folks who can't pay for their own health care at Planned Parenthood.
And how do you determine if someone's able to pay for their services?
There are wage scale analysis that our centers use to help folks determine that.
So do all health clinics have a person who looks at public policy, or is there something unique about Planned Parenthood that your role is needed?
Gosh, that's a great question. Lots of organizations have people who are focused on policy. Many nonprofits have that. I guess more clearly in other parts of the world, we're known as lobbyists. That becomes especially important role for organizations like Planned Parenthood, because, as you say, there's been pretty concerted attack on women, on the services that Planned Parenthood provides, on the whole notion of contraception and abortion and those kinds of issues. So it's a pretty important role at Planned Parenthood.
And what do you do from day to day? What are you working on currently? Is it bills on the table or making phone calls?
Sure. Our legislature is in recess right now. Folks may know that we have a part-time legislature. They'll come back for an organizational day in November and then get back to work in the first part of 2013. This will be an important year because it's a budget year. This is where our legislators set our state budget for the next 2 years. During the time legislators are not in Indianapolis every day, we're busy monitoring interim study committees that are starting to have hearings scheduled. We're talking with policymakers around the state to help them understand the issues that will be facing them when they get here in January. This year, especially because it's an election year, we're busy making sure that voters understand the issues that are important to families that relate to the work that Planned Parenthood does. So we're busy all year round.
What are those important issues, would you say, for this upcoming election?
For this upcoming election, I think the access to family planning services, to women's health services, are of critical importance. We've seen attacks around the country on contraception. We've seen restrictions, more and more restrictions on abortions. We've seen issues like personhood, which we can talk a little bit about later, come to the forefront. We see no reason why those issues are not going to come to Indiana, and we think that it's important for voters to understand what those are, to understand how they impact communities and how they impact families and how they impact individuals, and understand who they're voting for.
And I do want to talk about all those issues. I think we'll spend a lot of time talking about that. I think it's also important to get some history in, because it feels a little bit like a broken record this election cycle. Yeah. So I guess a little bit tongue in cheek, can we Are abortions legal in the United States, and when was that established?
Abortions are legal in the United States. That was established by a case known as Roe versus Wade from back in the 70s. And yes, the other thing to understand is that we hear a lot about the federal government's role in paying or providing funding for organizations that provide abortion services. It's important for folks to understand, and hopefully this message is clear, that federal funding is not available for funding for abortions, except in very, very select cases where there's been rape or a circumstance like that. So essentially no funding from federal money pays for abortions anywhere, despite what you might hear.
So I want to talk about the years since Roe v. Wade. I mean, I think it's been a long, long time since a female has been called a slut because she uses birth control. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the height of a big step for women sexually and being respected as part of the society to be mm-hmm. making these choices, to be able to speak about it openly. And now in 2012, this conversation is up again, and women are, I feel, under attack again. So what could have transitioned in those 40 years that we get right back to the same spot?
It is a little bit of a puzzle, isn't it? And it is an odd leap to go from the issue of abortion and extrapolate that out to contraception. I guess the best way I know to explain it is that there's a societal pendulum, and our pendulum, it seems like for the last 40 years, has moved to a more conservative place. It's troubling to see that rights that women have fought for and have won over time get lost, and they get lost through a rhetoric that isn't always based in fact, is divisive, is reactionary, and is something that doesn't seem to involve any sort of civil discourse. As a matter of fact, discourse seems to be not much of the picture at all. I think a trend toward the right in our society is probably the cause of that. I do also think that these kinds of issues are very divisive and can be used as a distraction for other kinds of policies. If we're all over to here arguing about whether or not women should have access to contraception or not, oftentimes we're not paying attention to important issues about how we're taxed, policies with foreign countries, what big business is doing, all of those kinds of things don't often get the attention that they should get. Hunger, families dealing with poverty, the underlying issues oftentimes get ignored because we're deciding whether women should have access to birth control or not.
You just mentioned the relationship between contraception and abortion. Right. And in fact, they seem to, one would mitigate the other. Can you talk about how that's become one discussion instead of two?
Yes. And I think you make a great point. I think for folks who are interested in reducing the number of abortions, the best two ways I can think of to do that, and the best two ways we know to do that, is number one, to have comprehensive sex education. So that young people grow up learning about their bodies, how to protect themselves, how to understand how their bodies work, so that they can be well educated. And the other thing is having access to contraception so that they know how to protect themselves. And part of the access to contraception, or I guess I should say it's more than access to contraception, it's having, again, the education in place. So people understand how to use contraception and understand the importance of using it correctly and regularly. And those are the best two ways I think there are to reduce the number of abortions here and all around the world. And frankly, we see it in our foreign policy. We celebrate places around the world where women get access to contraception and then are able to more thoughtfully determine how they and their families will grow and thrive. And we celebrate that. In our country, we seem less anxious to celebrate that kind of thing. Yes, I think there is a notion that the two things get thrown into the same conversation. I don't know if it's because it's easy to do that. I don't know if again, it's because it's a way to distract a different kind of conversation. I assume there's a mix of all of those things involved.
Since you mentioned the kind of the youth advocacy part of this, I'm wondering if you have any data over these last 40 years of any societal impact having access to contraceptives has had.
Sure. We know that every dollar that's spent on family planning services saves taxpayers $4 associated with the costs of unintended pregnancy. And I guess I'll preface all this by saying these issues are women's issues, but they're much beyond women's issues. They're people issues. And beyond being people and traditional human services issues, they're community development and their economic development issues, their workforce issues, their education issues. So again, I'll go back. And I always hope as I'm talking about these numbers, what I try to do is think of the real people I know who represent these numbers, because sometimes numbers can be, I don't know, a little cold and, not relevant to someone's real life. So think about these, that you get a paycheck every week or 2 weeks or month or whenever you get it, and some of your paycheck is going out for taxes. So this is your money. This is our money we're talking about. Every dollar that we invest in family planning services saves us $4 associated with the cost of unintended pregnancy. We know that poor birth spacing, people who don't have the opportunity to plan their families well, poor birth spacing leads to higher risk of low birth weight, to premature birth, and to developmental challenges, all of which contribute to the cycle of poverty. We know that. Indiana ranks 49th out of 50 in the U.S. in terms of access to family planning. 20% of the children in Indiana, so think about kids, 20% of kids, which is over 300,000, live in poor families. Between 2004 and 2008, we had a 23% increase in the number of children who live in poverty. So think about that in terms of human beings. Think about that in terms of what it costs us to pay for people who live in poverty. And it becomes pretty staggering pretty quickly.
So we're going to take a break and talk about what's going on just on the ground today with these same issues. All right, we'll be back in a moment. You are listening to Interchange on WFHB. back. You're listening to Interchange. I'm your host, Allison Bechtesh. I have here in the studio Catherine O'Connor, who is the Vice President of Public Policy for Planned Parenthood. Catherine, again, thank you for coming into the station today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having us.
So as I said at the top of the show, I've noticed that all the candidates for this 2012 election really feel like talking about women. And they all have their own opinions, obviously, and trying to differentiate themselves from those opinions. But even women's rights as compared to equal wages are mm-hmm. back on the table. That's a big discussion. And I remember when Mitt Romney's wife was the center of that for a week or two because she was talking about how much money she needed to live. And then it became an issue of women's pay again. Have you as well noticed that women are kind of the forefront of the discussion here?
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that, because despite the declarations that this election cycle is all about jobs, 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 and everyone's doing their best to make it about jobs, 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 what the discourse that we've seen so far has a lot to do with women's rights, reproductive rights, women's rights, reproductive rights, yes. So it's an interesting observation. And again, it's kind of a phenomenon, I guess, that as we talked about a little earlier, that this seems to have cycled back over this time. I think that the role that the Catholic Church has played in the notion of contraception has gotten all mixed up with the notion of providing insurance benefits. There are all kinds of ways that it continues, the reproductive rights and women's rights continue to make their way into other kinds of issues that candidates are talking about.
Absolutely. And that was another big couple of weeks where that's all that was discussed. And it was really in the bigger discussion of the Affordable Care Act, which has right. obviously been in the center of the news with the Supreme Court decision earlier at the end of last month. And I actually specifically wanted to ask about the Catholic Church, because I remember during that time when one side was saying, how dare the federal government tell a religious institution what to do. But then there's all these numbers that actually 80% of Catholics use contraception mm-hmm. already or support it. Mm-hmm. Do you have any numbers or any feel for that as well?
It's well over half of Catholic women have used contraception at some point in their lives. I think it's close to 98-99% of sexually active women overall who have used contraception in their lifetimes. So it's overwhelming. There's an interesting discussion about the church and the nuns in the church are not exactly lining up with how the bishops would like them to line up. And now apparently the church has assigned three bishops to take a look at the policies that this group of nuns has put in place for themselves to bring them back in line with the teachings of the Catholic Church. And I, as a matter of fact, earlier today had the opportunity to hear an interview with one of the sisters, and she was talking about the notion that this is the whole use of contraception in the church is one that the faithful have not followed despite the church's teachings on that. So it'll be interesting to see how that's resolved in the church. It's also a pretty interesting policy discussion to see how the church positions itself as both a charitable religious institution and an institution that participates in public services and has that kind of a role in the community too. I don't know the answer to that, but I think it's very interesting to see how that will resolve itself. And exactly what you're talking about, how the notion of providing insurance coverage to people of all faiths squares itself with religious institutions following the path that they believe has been lined out for them by their doctrine. It's a fascinating public policy discussion, as they say. It's one of the things that, in my opinion, makes public policy so much fun, is to struggle with those kinds of answers. And again, I don't presume to have the answer to it, but it'll be fascinating to see how it's resolved.
And since we're on the topic, I want to run with the Affordable Care Act a little further, mm-hmm. and issues that has brought up as as far as providing health to everyone, viewing Planned Parenthood as a health center instead of an abortion center. You know, I think it gets many names within that range as well. How has that legislation had an effect on Planned Parenthood or any of the policies that you're advocating for?
Sure. The Affordable Care Act is a fabulous advantage for people throughout our country. It will allow women to have coverage for their birth control without a copay, have well-woman exams without copays, and have direct access to OBGYNs so they can have those kinds of services available to them. We think in Indiana there'll be about 250,000 women who might become new clients and patients of Planned Parenthood. There's a lot of detail that has to happen as the Affordable Care Act becomes implemented. There's a very fast timeline for that to happen. There's the opportunity for states to expand the number of folks who are eligible for Medicaid as part of the Affordable Care Act. We don't know whether Indiana will take that opportunity or not. But as I say, it's a fast timeline for states to make those decisions and then start implementing. So a lot of that is still up in the air. A lot of the details under that are being worked through, not only in Indiana, but around the country. We're looking forward to Planned Parenthood being included as a provider. There are exchanges and providers who will be qualified, I guess is the best way to say it, under ACA. We're looking forward to Planned Parenthood being included among those. We do family planning and well woman exams and that kind of work, as well as any other organization in the state, and we're looking forward to the opportunity to have a significant presence there.
I'm curious, too, you know, some of the people who are against the Affordable Care Act, there's been a lot on the business side, employers not wanting to provide coverage for all their employees or saying that that will be hard on business. A lot of the pharmaceutical companies and healthcare on the back end, too, have issues with it. Can you give me any look into the pharmaceutical companies that produce birth control and how they react to the ability for more citizens to have access to their product?
I don't have a lot of expertise in the area of the implementation and the business end of it. But as I say, it's it opens up the possibility for many, many more women and families to determine for themselves how best to grow and thrive. And so we hope that the business issues get resolved. We hope that we have the opportunity to continue providing high-quality, affordable family planning services to folks and making contraception available. And we're very excited about that opportunity.
Okay. Well, you talked a little bit about the Medicaid funds that may actually grow should Indiana choose to follow some of the other regulations, which seems very similar to a discussion that was had a lot last year in 2011 when the Indiana legislation passed and was signed into law by Governor Daniels, HEA 1210, which was trying to, you know, the language of the bill, trying to separate funds from the state and the federal government from funds that were going towards abortions. You've already said that that is the case. Let's start with some of the history of that bill, just so that's been clear to the listeners. What was the purpose of that bill?
The essential purpose of that bill was to defund Planned Parenthood. I think that was the bottom line.
And what language did they use to try and get around that?
Well, it disqualifies Planned Parenthood from being eligible to be a Medicaid provider. So that would mean that the thousands of folks in Indiana who got services from Planned Parenthood, as you say, much beyond, not for abortion and beyond contraception, could no longer take advantages of those services in Indiana.
And that was passed and signed into law. there was an injunction on that, and it is still being debated. Can you give me the most recent update?
Sure. Actually, there were two pieces of that. The Federal Department of Health and Human Services had an administrative question that they have recently ruled on again for the second time, that qualified providers cannot be prohibited from providing services to Medicaid patients, and that Planned Parenthood is a qualified provider. So, and I guess it's important to say that from this whole time that this law was passed in Indiana, and there's been the injunctions, and we've been waiting for the hearings, Planned Parenthood has been open, has been providing services and providing services to Medicaid patients. So we continue to do that, and we'll continue to do that. We're still waiting for the Court of Appeals to rule on the other part of this law, and we anticipate that ruling coming really at any time.
And let's begin by you telling me the general climate in Indiana as it relates to public policy for access to family planning healthcare.
Challenging. it seems that our state has made it tougher and tougher for families to take advantage of family planning services in our state.
Why?
I don't know why. I think there is a notion among a certain sector of our community in Indiana that folks should be practicing a different philosophy of family planning. And I guess it's important to say here, a lot of that has to do with abstinence. Planned Parenthood is not anti-abstinence. As a matter of fact, we talk about abstinence plus. It would be fabulous if everyone who lived in our state and in our country and in our world was in a loving, supporting relationship, was well prepared to have children at the time the children came along, practiced safe sex. But in reality, we know that that's not what happens. We know that among young people in Indiana, some 70% of them are sexually active by the time they're juniors in high school. And I'm gonna go back to my numbers a little bit. Indiana has some 30 girls a day who become pregnant. That's a class. Again, go back to thinking of teenagers. You know, that's a classroom of girls who are becoming pregnant every day. They're not abstinent. Human beings tend to not be abstinent. So what we try to do is recognize the practicality of that and understand that if folks are not practicing abstinence, what can we do to help them, as they talked about earlier, understand how their bodies work, understand the ramifications of having sex, the ramifications of having unprotected sex, and how to be thoughtful about how they make those decisions, whatever age they are. And that's a difference in philosophy, I guess, is the best way I know to think about it. And I can't explain for folks who feel differently about it how the whole depth of that philosophy.
Sure. Another thing you mentioned earlier is that these kind of discussions are kind of, it's an easy win, you know, for Indiana Republicans who pushed these through, and obviously the Republican governor signed it. And I think very political party based. You know, this is one of those issues where you can tell which party you're in by how you think about this issue. And I don't know if that is in reality, but definitely one party's been classified, you're okay with this. One party's been classified, you're not. So it seems like kind of an easy win for Indiana conservatives. What are they trying to make us look away from, and why are they building this kind of easy win dog and pony show, as you said?
Sure. And I guess I might disagree a little bit, because what we find is that across the spectrum, there's a terrific amount of support for the kinds of notions that Planned Parenthood and progressives talk about. Even for folks who don't necessarily support abortion, there's pretty across the board support for the notion of contraception and of having Planned Parenthood be in existence as a provider of healthcare services to women and to their families. So I don't, maybe there are not a lot of people in both parties who are loud about how they talk about it, but as they say, we find pretty across the board support for those kinds of notions. And I guess I would not presume to understand the whole notion of the right's political agenda. But again, I will say, I know that it's a notion of more traditional conservative family values, and that's an agenda that they believe in strongly and that they push hard. And those traditional values, I think, envision a two-parent family, where there's a traditional role of a husband and a wife. There's a man and a woman, mm-hmm. as opposed to two men or two women. And as they say, a more traditional perspective on life that I don't know is in tune with what we really live every day.
So in a state like Indiana, especially where the legislature is has a majority in both the House and the Senate, mm-hmm. How do you maintain access to health care for those who can't afford to go to doctors and instead go to clinics like Planned Parenthood?
We try very hard to help the broad spectrum of the population. As I mentioned, there's a broad spectrum of support. We try very hard to help people understand, to have a rational, fact-based understanding of the pieces of legislation, of the issues that are in front of voters. It's very important for people to understand who they're voting for. We learned that a lot with the workers who were involved in the right to work issue, that many of those folks voted for candidates based on a single issue without looking at the whole spectrum of what a candidate's whole platform or beliefs were. And then were surprised when they found how those candidates voted on issues that were of interest to them. So it's very important. It's very, very important for an electorate to be able to think critically and to be able to inform themselves. There'll be candidates, and there always will be candidates and always have been candidates, who have a wide variety of views and who have effective ways to get those messages out. In my opinion, it's very incumbent upon all of us as members of the community and as members of the electorate to inform ourselves. That's as important as actually getting out and voting. If you're voting for someone who you don't know what that person's positions are on things, then you're wasting a pretty important opportunity, especially this year, especially when there are such important things at stake for families, for women, for communities, because as I continue to believe and talk about, those things are all so interconnected.
You say especially this year, perhaps because this last session, there was a bill that was passed by the Senate. It didn't go through, but depending on who's the makeup of the assembly is when we come back in January, it'll be on the table again. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about this bill that was also concerning abortion, some things that the doctors needed, doctor-patient relationship issues, and some of the clinic regulations that were put into this bill that was passed in the Senate this 2012 General Assembly?
Sure. And again, you're right, and it's important to note that while the bill did pass in the House, or I'm sorry, in the Senate, it did not pass in the House, so it is not law. That was another example of restricting women's access to the services that are provided by Planned Parenthood and some other organizations in the state. There were really three primary components of that. Number one is that bill required that additional information, we believe not always fact-based information, have to be provided to a woman before she received an abortion. It intruded significantly on a doctor's relationship with her patient or his patient. It required doctors to provide information to their patients that wasn't always relevant to a patient. Again, we believe not always factually, scientifically based.
Can you give any examples of what they needed to show or tell them?
Pictures of fetuses along the different stages of development, that kind of thing. It required doctors to have admitting privileges at hospitals, or to have a relationship with a doctor who did have admitting privileges, which limits a doctor's ability to provide services. I think the primary concern with that bill was the intrusion of the doctor-patient relationship. A wonderful thing about this country is that all of us may feel very differently about all kinds of important issues. But I don't necessarily want a legislator or me or anyone intruding into my relationship with my doctor and me. That's a very special relationship, and legislators need to stay out of that relationship. They need to stay out of doctor's offices.
We're going to go to break again in a moment and then come back for our final segment here. But so this brings to light that there actually are a lot of doctor's offices where abortion discussions happen. So Planned Parenthood is not the only abortion provider here in the state. Why is Planned Parenthood, the organization, being attacked when people can go to their doctors and doctor's offices and get these same services?
Yes, and I'll clarify, I don't think there are other abortion providers in the state. I don't know that every doctor in the state provides abortions. So, but I think the answer to your question is that Planned Parenthood's a pretty easy target. You know, we're out there, we're well-known, we're well-established, and I think Planned Parenthood's an easy target.
All right, we'll be back in a moment. You are listening to Interchange on WFHB. I'm your host, Allison Bechtesh. I am here with my guest, Catherine O'Connor, who is the VP of Public Policy for Planned Parenthood of Indiana. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
We're back listening to Interchange on WFHB. I'm your host tonight, Allison Bechtesh, and I do have in the studio with me Catherine O'Connor, who's the Vice President of Public Policy for Planned Parenthood of Indiana, visiting us down from Indianapolis. Thanks for coming in today.
My pleasure.
And I'm going to follow up a little bit just from what we were talking about right before the break. I guess my question is, if this legislation were to successfully shut down Planned Parenthood, mm-hmm. that 1210 that's still being debated, would abortion stop in Indiana?
No. Abortions have been around as long as pregnancies have been around. The opportunity that we have and that people have fought so hard to have in our law is the opportunity for women who find themselves in a position to have an abortion, can have an abortion in a safe environment. We all know the horror stories. And frankly, to a point that you made earlier, there's some thinking that people who have come of age since Roe versus Wade maybe don't have a firsthand picture of what life was like that. Before that, the notion that a wife had to have her husband's permission to take contraceptives, to get birth control pills, the notion of back alley abortions, the awful, awful things that took place before this service was this was legal. I think it's foolish and naive to think abortions would stop if they were outlawed.
And I'll clarify again that this legislation is trying to take away help for patients who are on Medicaid for
right.
Planned Parenthood. It can't actually take away funding for abortions since that has nothing to do with federal funds. So what are the impacts if a bill like this were to go through in Indiana where Medicaid was removed from supporting this organization? What impacts would that have on those who are going to the clinic? And as you say, it's a bigger community on the whole, on all yeah. of Indiana.
The immediate impact is to cut out services to almost 10,000 patients who come to Planned Parenthood and many, many thousands beyond that who get well woman exams, who get breast exams, who get testing for STDs, and get family planning services. So it's a pretty short-sighted notion to my way of thinking.
And I'm curious, was there a provision within that bill as to what would happen to Medicaid patients who all of a sudden lost their provider?
There was a notion that there were some 800 other providers in the state who could pick up those services right away. We've done an analysis of that list of 800 providers. And what among the things we looked at was whether the provider was accepting new Medicaid patients, what kind of a wait time, did the provider have the same kind of services that Planned Parenthood has. And we find that when you go through that kind of an exercise, the list narrows pretty dramatically.
All right. Well, we've spoken over the last 40 minutes, we've definitely touched on the history of women's reproductive rights and some of the legislation here in Indiana. I want to open the conversation up a little bit more to look nationally. Indiana is not the only state where healthcare for reproductive rights is on the table. And I know that some states have had some victories and some states have gone even farther than legislation Indiana has passed concerning the women's right to choose. Are there any particular successes that you've seen at other Planned Parenthoods that you can talk about?
The most significant success that we've seen in the last year probably is the repeated defeat of what's known as personhood initiatives. Most surprisingly and happily in the state of Mississippi, which is a pretty conservative state, personhood is the notion that an unborn fetus takes on all the rights of a human being. That's a pretty dramatic policy shift. We're thrilled that the voters in Mississippi understood the ramifications of that, understood the extreme nature of that kind of a public policy, and voted no. And we've seen similar kinds of initiatives start and fail more than once in some other states. So we expect that that will come to Indiana. Again, I'll go back to the importance of being a well-informed, critically thinking electorate. Many of those initiatives have been ballot initiatives. That's not a way we tend to do business here in Indiana. Ours, we suspect, will come more as a legislative proposal. And then it becomes, again, incumbent upon all of us as voters to elect people that we think will reflect our policy views on that kind of an issue.
There is a case right now in Indiana, I don't know if you are watching this at all, with a woman who tried to take her own life and mm-hmm. was pregnant. Mm-hmm. And it's very much on that personhood issue because she's being tried as if she was committing murder. Can you talk about that case at all?
A little bit. We're aware of the case. We've not followed it closely, but I think the issue is exactly one that you raise. And that is working its way through the courts and will have an impact on how our policy evolves as a result of that case. It's one of the cases that will influence how our laws get put in place down the line.
So speaking of policy and looking into the future, I'm curious as to any initiatives that you are working on now. You said it is the downtime, the General Assembly is not in effect. So what is going on in your office? What are some key points that you really hope do get addressed in the next session, and how do you see that working out?
We hope that I'll start legislatively, and then I'm going to go a little bit backwards chronologically. Legislatively, we hope that there is a civil discussion about important issues that affect all of us overall. To the extent that discussion involves reproductive rights, we hope that there is a well-informed electorate who are being in touch with their representatives about how they feel about the pieces of legislation that are being considered. We hope that people are in touch with their legislators. We hope that they're willing to come to the State House to talk about how they feel about those issues. We hope that they don't just stay silent on the sidelines. That's the most dangerous thing that we can do. Before all that happens, we'll elect a lot of new members to our General Assembly, and we'll have a new governor and a new president. There isn't anything more important that people can do than to inform themselves about who the candidates are, to understand not only what the candidates are saying in their speeches, but to go back and look at what they've done in their careers, look at what their policies have been, understand what their philosophies are, go to events where candidates are speaking, ask questions, and understand the positions. And based on that information and reading and being well-informed, vote that way. Vote for candidates that reflect the values that each of us hold.
It seems like a lot of your work is looking at policies that have been drafted and trying to speak to people so that they don't go through. Is it possible to draft a policy that says from here on out, women get to choose, or women get access to health care, or low-income families can go to Planned Parenthood?
We'd love the opportunity to do that, and we hope to have the opportunity to do that. Unfortunately, because of the nature of our General Assembly, those measures that have been introduced that are like that in the last few years haven't had much success, but we'll keep at it. We have great champions around the state, including our own champion from Bloomington, Vice Simpson, who's been a wonderful, wonderful supporter of Planned Parenthood, of women's rights, of people's rights for her entire career. There are people like that who are around who are champions, and we hope to continue being able to have those proposals and in the future maybe have those proposals have more success. But again, the best way to make sure that happens, and you can tell that maybe our focus through this fall is getting people out to vote, is to go vote and know who you're voting for.
Well, I'm glad you say that because it brings us back to the election season. And I think that it is women's issues that are being discussed this election season. And, you know, it kind of feels good. It kind of feels like women have the power in this debate because that's who you're trying, whatever candidate, that's who you're speaking to if you're speaking about these issues. So, I mean, it's kind of funny that in debating issues that take away women's rights or women's comfort with her own body, you're actually putting her in power to determine the entire slate, like you said, from our local representatives all the way to the president this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And you're absolutely right. Women are and have been 51% of the population. We do have the power. And we know that when women get involved, women know how to make things happen. So there were a large number of women who didn't turn out to vote in 2010, and we see what happened as a result of that. So if we think we'd like to see something happen differently in 2012, we need to exercise our voices. We need to be the 51%. We need to make the difference. We need to understand how these policies impact us and all of the people we love, and we need to get out and vote.
And I also want to talk at the very beginning of the show, you explained that one thing you do as vice president of public policy is make these relationships with legislators, but you also do community partnerships. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about those and if there's an aspect that relates between those and some sex ed in the state, which you said is also a good way of informing the public.
Sure. Well, as we talked about, this all, in our opinion, this all starts with comprehensive sex ed. And Planned Parenthood has a whole division of our office who has community partnerships who can present sexuality education to all kinds of different audiences, from young people all the way through adults, help adults understand how to talk to the young people in their lives about sexuality, which sometimes can be an awkward conversation. So we present those programs all over the state. We have a variety of topics that can be covered in those curricula, and we have folks on our staff who are happy to be in touch and see how we can set up programs with all kinds of organizations.
Okay, and looking again at the bigger future and our bigger picture and into the future, have you noticed or are you in touch with the greater Planned Parenthood organization, a changing tide against this kind of push back against the discussion that is back in our rhetoric after 40 years about women's rights? Have you seen groups start to come together as we get closer and closer to the election?
Yes. Nationally, yes. You know, we talked about Mississippi and the defeat of the personhood initiatives and other states where the personhood initiatives have been tried. I think the other famous thing that happened this spring was the whole notion of the transvaginal ultrasound and the defeat of that. So yes, we do see that. In Indiana, I see a growing interest in coalitions that represent a variety of interests, of human service type of interests, coming together maybe to have a stronger voice. So I think it's early. I wish we were farther along, but yeah, I think there's always hope for the future. I think there's always room for folks who feel engaged, who are advocates at heart and who want to get engaged. We're happy to have folks on board with us.
Well, Catherine, thank you again for coming down to the WFHB studios to speak with us today.
My pleasure, Allison. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Interchange on WFHB. I'm your host, Allison Bechtesh. My guest has been Catherine O'Connor, who is here. She's the Vice President of Public Policy for Planned Parenthood of Indiana. Today's program was produced by Kara Weaver. Interchange is produced by Lewis Malone. I'm the executive producer, Allison Bechtesh. Our original theme music is by Jamil Effiam. Thanks for listening to Interchange.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.